the sound of rolling luggage on cobblestone. That old ostinato soundtrack that was, before lockdown at least, practically the national anthem of half of Western Europe. It's been a little over 40 years since a Northwest Airlines pilot named Bob Plath, in a moment of inspiration, jammed wheels on a standing suitcase like chocolate into peanut butter and created the first rollerboard. And eventually it led to where we are here, an Airbnb before COVID, just outside of Porto, Portugal, where my old friend, the photojournalist Eduardo Leal, is telling me about how the Rodinhas, the rolling luggage people, changed his hometown. We have three episodes here in Porto, and it seems natural to start by talking about tourism. Yeah, there's no tourism right now, but it will be back. I did some volunteer shifts at New York City's vaccination pods last week, and the main thing that me and those lucky people in the vaccine lines talked about was where we would visit first when it was safe. But for all the thirst we need to know, the travel should be better when we get back to it. It was not always working for the world. In the before times, it flooded and warped the town of Porto in ways that Eduardo knows better than most. See, Eduardo is from here, but he left, like the Portuguese have been doing for millennia, to find his fortune outside his native country. I actually first met him out yonder in South America. He started his international photojournalism career by shooting for Roads and Kingdoms in Venezuela, and I traveled and worked with him in Brazil, in Petropolis, in Sao Paulo, and Rio de Janeiro. But here, in my time in Porto, he is both host and guest, from this place, but no longer of it. In this episode, we're talking about all that, about the changing city, his life and career, and about those mountains of cheese and meat they call Francesinhas. Before we get into that, though, just one thing about those rolling bags, for when we are lucky enough to travel again. A little plea, a simple, sane request. For God's sakes, roll those things on pavement or concrete or asphalt, tarmac, bamboo, bitumen. But do not, when the sun is softly swanning between two bell towers in the old city of Porto, and the white wine is arriving by the carafe at a small metal table lining the alley, do not roll that fucking thing down the middle of the cobblestone street. If you do, you will be a Rodinha, and that we will not forgive. This is Nathan Thornburg, and from Roads and Kingdoms, you are listening to The Trip, drinking with exceptional people around the world. I think we should open this wine.
The other one?
Yeah, your wine.
Yeah.
No, sorry. I'm looking at this Airbnb here in Porto is run by... I don't know what the fuck is happening with Airbnb, but this looks like a concierge or like a hospitality company. It's probably just a dude on a moped who was he was like an hour late yesterday and called me. He said my friend like 70 times in 5 minutes, which is not a sign of trustworthiness. Anyway, he came and let us in. But this whole thing is run by something that calls itself the Porto Concierge, which is not an organization I have a tremendous amount of faith in. But they have like their own white label red wine.
Yeah.
And they left a bottle, which I do not plan on drinking.
You can take it with you if you want.
I mean, this
for the trip, maybe.
750 milliliters of wine needs to be spent better than an Airbnb concierge group. You know, like I'm in fucking Portugal. I can get some great wine, I'm sure. So maybe that'll be my gift to someone that I care a little bit about, but not a lot.
No, and it's weird because in Portugal we have a lot of regions for wine.
Yeah.
And they don't even say where it comes in the country, this wine. So it can be, you know, a mix of all the regions and it's like, oh, it's cheaper like that or something.
Yeah, danger sign. It comes from Airbnb headquarters. All right. So fuck that bottle. Let's go and get stuff.
You never have green wine.
Green wine?
Yeah, it's the region.
I've never had green wine in the home of green wine.
Maybe.
Here's the label. Walk me through what we're pouring here. Now, you said that unlike our Airbnb wine, this actually has a region that it comes from that they're proud to discuss.
Yeah, well, basically, well, Alvarinho comes from a really specific region. It's north of Portugal, but it's made around the borders with Spain in two small towns called Monção and Melgaço. And so basically this is a monocast. It's a white wine, a really specific white wine. But in this region, they call a green wine. It's a dry wine and it has a kind of fruity flavor. And it's a bit kind of sparkling. So, you know, it's why it's a bit different from the normal white wine that you usually drink.
And that's why they call it green, because it's got a little bubble to it.
Bubble to it.
Yeah. And I do love the, I mean, they've got this like kind of on tap in bars around here.
Yeah.
And it's just like very bubbly. Mm-hmm. Maybe like a couple of euros for a porron, or like a little, not a porron, but like a small flat pitcher of it. I mean, it's like devastatingly cheap.
And well, Alvarinho is a bit more expensive.
Yeah.
Because it's, let's see, the supreme of the green wine.
This is like the leader.
The leader,
the supreme leader of all of our green wines.
Because it's all with one vine in a specific place. So it's, you don't have a big region to produce this wine. So also it's extreme good quality, but also you don't have a big production of it.
Where and how far away from Porto does this stuff come from?
I will say around, well, I can see, 2 hours more or less. It's up north with the border with Spain.
Yeah.
Actually, my grandma that I was telling about the cooking, she comes from Melgaço.
Your grandmother's from Melgaço?
Yeah, she's from one of the towns where they used to produce, where they still produce this wine.
Oh, so you have an inside connection to the green wine.
Yeah.
Well, here's to grandma, man. Here's to her health and all the green wine she can metabolize at her age. Huh?
Cheers.
That's great.
I like it.
I'm not against this at all. And no part of me is unhappy about any part of that. Good. I mean, the sun is shining outside. There's a wickedly cold bottle that you got here, and it's just like constant refreshment. Mm-hmm. From a wine.
The problem with this is that it goes really easily down.
Yeah.
And you drink it like it's a juice.
It's the old Zima problem.
And then, you know, you get to a point that you drank too much and your head is already spinning.
Great. That'll be at minute 32 of this podcast.
Well, let's get to that. Oh, man.
I had, a combination always of jet lag, maybe, you know, sort of lack of food and high alcohol makes for great podcasting. Tremendous podcast conditions. So I would say lack of food for us, but I'm still full from the meal that we had last night.
The first thing. Yeah.
Yeah, it's now 3:15 p.m. I haven't had a thing to eat, and it's like I had three meals already today. there's something that's feeding me like I've got like a, you know, like an IV.
Yeah.
And I think it's the francesinha, which you were kind of pissed, I think, yesterday that the very first meal that I had in Porto was not the francesinha. Like, you were sort of pouting through a soup that we had because it was the food that was right there. And, you know, we were going to save it. Why does everybody need to have a francesinha as the very first thing they eat in Porto?
Well, I don't know if it's the first time you have to, as the first meal, but you cannot miss it. The thing with yesterday, it was that, like, come on, he came from so far, it's the first time he's in Portugal, and we're not going to take him to a proper place. And we care about food in this country. So for me, it was like, okay, you know, we go to a more normal place where, you know, it's not that the food is not nice, but you can have that almost anywhere. You could have that in New York, for example.
It was kind of a quiche and vegetable soup kind of spot.
So
it was more the paranoia that the schedule of like this festival that we're at and stuff will catch up with me. I will be forced to leave on Sunday not having had a francesinha.
Exactly.
And therefore anger the gods and
And you will never be allowed again in Porto.
That's right. Just kind of destroy my good standing in the country. Fortunately, we don't have to worry about that. We got the Francesinha. Yeah. But that wasn't your place yesterday.
No. But I'm a kind of, since I don't live in Portugal anymore, it's difficult for me because I'm a bit orphan of my Francesinha place. Because unfortunately, my Francesinha place went a bit downhill in the last years for placing my standard.
Yeah.
So I'm a bit kind of moving from place to place and still finding exactly the one that satisfies me the most.
Wow.
As we were talking, you know, it's like a religion, or, you know, your own chapel, the place where you eat your own Francesinha. And I used to have one specific place. And yeah, I think it's because it got bigger and everything, more pressure from tourism to serve much more. And it's only two people working there.
Yeah.
I feel that they had to cut some corners. And I think the quality went a bit down. So
now you're a man without a country, a man without a faith, a weird Unitarian of Francesinhas. Yeah. I mean, do you need to find a home? Do you need to? Because I noticed we were out with a group of people from Porto last night, and there was a lot of arguing about which place to go to. Maybe you don't have, like, maybe you can't be as forceful in that argument as you know, someone from here needs to be, until you find that one place that you'll then just sort of beat up your friends about.
Yeah, you need your own, like, you know, and it's a kind of awesome neighborhood. We are quite here. We are a bit like kind of, you know, as you saw my friend yesterday from Matosinhos, he's like, the place where we eat, this is the place, because it's also a Matosinhos place. And then if you are in Porto, you will be like, no, here in my neighborhood, we have this is, you know, we are quite neighborhood people. Porto, we call Porto a nation. You know, usually you have this saying, oh, Porto é uma nação.
Okay.
So like Porto is a nation, because we have this kind of thing with the capital in Lisbon. You know, I think there's this thing, well, in Spain with Barcelona and Madrid, you know.
Right.
And we are the second city, and we have this kind of rivalry, and we always try to, you know, push ourselves up, and, you know, we are like different from the rest.
I get that, yeah.
And that then translates as well into neighborhoods and everything. Probably as you have in New York with, Brooklyn and the Bronx, and I don't know.
It happens with those boroughs. I mean, I remember that with San Francisco, where I grew up part of the time, just their feeling as the second city to LA made them care a lot. And it had this, like, San Francisco, you know, every newscast, which I think I've mentioned on this podcast from San Francisco before, is like, you know, KTVU 2 always starts with "Good morning from the greatest place on earth." You know, yeah. Just like over the top shit that people would say, because in deep down there's like an insecurity, and like, being that second city is a special place. So I know what about Matosinhos, which is the neighborhood we're in, which is it's kind of just outside of Porto, into the north. Maybe the third or fourth thing that Tiago, who's organizing this festival, mentioned to me was, if you run into the mayor, don't tell him how much you like Porto.
Yeah.
We're in Matosinhos. He'll kill me.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Tell me a little bit about Porto and growing up here.
Well, one thing is that the city changed a lot. I say the Porto city now is not the city I left 16 years ago. Porto is a lively gray city, usually surrounded by fog.
It's a lively gray city.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Lively because people of Porto live, they wear, as you say, wear their hearts as a sleeve.
Yeah, they wear their hearts on their sleeves.
And they are quite rowdy, lively, swearing a lot. And then you have the gray. And this, the gray, comes from a lot of the, not just the weather, because actually, you know, Porto is a gray city usually. But also through this architecture. And if you walk in the center of the city and in the old town, you will understand that. There's a lot of shades and small, narrow alleys. And then the color of the buildings, they are they are dirty. It's not, well, now they are cleaning. It's why I said that the city is a bit different now. It's not my city.
You motherfuckers went and cleaned the buildings, and now Eduardo doesn't even know where he is anymore.
But this gray thing is that it's the passage of time. We have to think that Porto has around 800 years as a city. So, you know, the old buildings, they have this gray of the passage of time. And I love that. I think it tells so much about it. And I think the difference now is that it's so clean that it doesn't seem the same place anymore.
Man, progress sucks. That's actually true for Porto. Like, speaking of my Airbnb concierge and everything, like, Porto is a city, like I think a lot of Portugal, that has, you know, in a time of economic crisis, has turned to tourism as like a major, you know, a major component of its economy. And you see it here in Porto. And you know, I think you had been talking about central Porto, where you grew up in, as a place that is now dominated by the wheel people.
The rodinhas.
You got to tell me about the wheel people. Who are they, and how can I avoid being one of them?
Well, first, don't carry a luggage with the small wheels around the city.
Fair enough. Leave your fucking rolly bag at home.
And try to be maybe a bit quiet, you know, when you move around with that luggage. Bring a backpack. I think, you know, a light backpack will be easier. Oh,
but then you're stuck because, like, maybe you're one of the wheel people, or the only other option is to be a backpacker. I gotta be something else. There's gotta be another way. I did, you know, after we had talked about that yesterday, I went down to central Portugal, or to Porto in the center, and was outside having some vino verde on tap, and immediately like three Northern Europeans came down a fully cobblestone street in the middle of the street. And the cobblestones are legit. They're not, you know, they're not meant for easy, you know, this is no slicked tramway. And they were all rolling bags behind them. And it sounded, I mean, the clacking was like incredible. So who told you this name of the rodinhas, the wheel people?
Rodinhas, it's basically, we call it, a long time ago, I used to go to this Tasca. And Tasca is like, you know, this small old restaurant, usually it's not even frequented, it's habitated by, you know, real local people that they spend all the time
there. They're not clients, they're like tenants.
Yeah, they are tenants, exactly. And basically, well, this Tasca, it's in the old part of town, in Ribeira, and it's run by two women. It's the mother and the daughter. The mother is 90 years old. She's running the restaurant for 70 years, and the daughter is around her 50-something years. And I used to go there a lot, and the last time I was there, she was complaining that the neighborhood was dying, because she was like, look to the buildings around us, there's no one living. When before you had women shouting from window to window, and you had the clothes hanging, you know, now you look and you don't see anything. It's quite beautiful now because it's all arranged, you know, the buildings, some were collapsing or something, which for me gave some charm. It's like, you know, going back to a van and then it's all brand new,
right?
You know, in a way it gave some charm. But but the reality is that the people, because of all this makeover, they cannot afford the rent.
And Ribeira used to be a tough neighborhood,
a tough neighborhood,
a very real neighborhood.
Yeah.
There was some story about, what was it, the British soccer hooligans were trying to start some shit in Ribeira, and they were fighting the cops off and actually winning. I think this is Diogo. Whose brother was a cop. No, Tiago. Brother was a cop. I was telling this story, and that the police started to lose, and then all the men of Ribeira came out and just started kicking the shit out of the British hooligans, you know, on behalf of the police, I guess, and maybe on behalf of the pride of the neighborhood, that they weren't going to see a beatdown happen on their watch. I doubt that the roly people, the wheel people, would have done the same, in part because they're probably all Liverpool fans.
Well, yeah, and people of Ribeira was always hardcore and tough and everything, but they were also the soul, I think, of the city. That's the reality. And I think this evacuation, like let's say this, of people from the old town is also taking a bit of that, is losing its soul.
Yeah,
it's like almost a metaphor of it, of these people leaving and how the city is transforming. And the woman was telling me that, yeah, you know, this is changing so much, and the Rodinhas, the wheelie,
the roly people, the roly, wheel people, I don't
the
know,
people, yeah. The Rodinhas. Yeah. I think it sounds much better in Portuguese, the name. So I will say it, the Rodinhas. Basically, she was saying, yeah, it's nice that they can come here because obviously they give some business, but the problem is when there's no one here, and who they're gonna see? They're gonna Rodinhas come to see Rodinhas. So wheel people come to see wheel people because there's no more to see other than the buildings.
Right.
But the soul, the social fabric of what was Ribeira and the old town, it ceased to exist, basically.
And for a brief moment, a restaurant like Tashka would have, you know, would be an undiscovered gem for your average wheel person, your tourist with a rolly bag, as they sort of manage to have a meal or a drink in and amongst the locals, the inhabitants of Ribeira and of Tashka. But that moment passes quickly then. They get excited about it, and then, you know, people are like, man, this neighborhood is so gritty, like, let's go there on our week-long vacation and stay there. And then before you know it, Porto Concierge is running a bunch of Airbnbs in Ribeira. I don't know if they actually are, but someone like them, and you've got now a neighborhood that is just an empty signifier of what Porto used to be. I mean, it's funny because I, you know, I'm a rank and abject sentimentalist, and, you know, we did a whole series from the Mission District in San Francisco, which to me, like you're saying about Ribeira, felt like the heart of the city. And when you clean it up and push out the, you know, undesirables and so on, then you're losing something that you don't even know until long after it's gone.
It's gone, yeah. And you don't recover that. You cannot just call people and let's move in back. You will never reconstruct that.
Yeah.
That neighborhood, that the atmosphere, because that's not fake. That was grew up with time and with generations. And you know, you cannot just this was a mistake and let's go back and, you know.
Yeah,
it doesn't work like that.
I feel it's like the Velveteen Rabbit theory of, you know, sort of neighborhoods. It's like the more worn and like cared for something is, the more kind of ineffable and irreplaceable its value. Mm-hmm. I mean, somebody's making money, and I guess it's a Portuguese person, you know.
Depends.
Kind of. Yeah.
There's people like the company, I think, that runs this place where we are.
Yeah.
I know people that rent flats and everything, but one of the problems, we have to think that Portugal was in a big economical crisis a few years ago. And as we said, you know, the tourism was like a life saving to many families and everything. And but also for all this attention for Porto and Portugal brought a lot of foreign investments.
Got it.
And a lot for Portuguese is expensive. But if you ask a German, a French person, or English or American, and you say, oh, you know, you can buy a 3 or 4 bedroom flat for 500,000 euros. Maybe for you that come from New York, it's nothing. It's like,
in theory,
I can't afford either. But, you know, in theory,
yeah,
it's much more appealing. And then you have cheap lifestyle here because Portugal is still a cheap country. You have good weather usually, you know, you have good food. So. And I think that helps as well on the down of the loss of, you know, a bit of the culture and, you know.
Yeah. Well, let's, on that note, let's get back into the
Vinho Verde.
The Vinho Verde, the Alvarinho. And what is the difference between an Alvarinho like this and, I mean, there's a Alvarinho from Spain, which I guess is maybe a little better known.
Yeah, that's the problem with the... Well, again.
Cheers.
Cheers. Unfortunately, and well, I don't think it's unfortunate, but the reality is that it's not just with Alvarinho, but with all the Portuguese wines, is that we lack marketing. We don't lack quality comparing with French wines or California Australians. But the reality, we lack foreign marketing for, you know, outside, but also because you know, we are such a small country that the production is not that big. And also, we consume, if you go to here in Portugal, you don't see a foreign wine almost. It's almost impossible for you to find a French wine in a supermarket or Argentinian wine. You don't find it. Well, some places, they are still have a small section, but it's not a common thing. Because we have, for our size, we have a large production of wine.
Yeah.
But not to export, except port wine and the rosé.
Right. Well, that's a little fucked up. Like, if you were going to, you know, be bringing a bunch of foreign wine in here, it'd be like bringing like some deli takeout to grandma's house, you know, after she cooked you a meal, like, it's here already. Like, you got the good stuff. Like, why pay money for the rest? But also, I mean, in particularly when you're talking about Albariño or Alvariño, like, you have a very large neighbor who just kind of has much more resources to capture, you know, mental mind share across the globe for their wines and their food, some of which, you know, whether it's like conservas, the, you know, tinned seafood, or whether it's these kind of amazing fresh white wines that they have in northern Spain and up here in northern Portugal, like, you guys are, you know, you're kind of in the same area doing sort of the same thing. They're just doing it with a lot more recognition.
Same happens with the olive oil and what is the other one? Well, and the Parma ham. Because we produce really good Parma ham and in Alentejo, the south of Portugal.
Yeah.
And yeah, and olive oil, we have exceptional olive oil, but you never heard about olive oil from Portugal, probably.
Listen, not to bag on the Spaniards, because...
I know you have a special...
I have a special connection. I've got friends and family, you know, our partner, all of this stuff. But I had always thought, you know, I think one of the... at least one of the most memorable early pieces that we published from you was about Forcados, which is kind of a long-running obsession of yours, and you've made this incredible work of photography around them. And if there was something that just struck me as a difference between two countries on the same peninsula that a lot of people, myself included, are not great at differentiating distinctly, I mean, the difference between Forcados and like real like bullfighter culture in Spain seems instructive. I don't know if there's anything else we can extrapolate, but tell me about the Forcados and like, and you know, who they are and what they do and what makes them kind of unique.
Well, in Portugal, to start with, to give a bit of context, Forcado, well, in Portugal, you cannot kill the bull in the arena. That's illegal. There's only one small town in the border with Spain that still has that tradition, that fought over the law and is respected. And so basically they still...
It's like the Texarkana of the Iberian Peninsula. Yeah. Like they're going to be fucking Texans.
Exactly. Okay.
All right.
But other than that, it's since the 1850s, it's not legal to kill the bull in the arena in Portugal. And they had to find...
That's a long time before PETA and, you know, sort of general animal welfare.
But all happens because of a queen that was ruling Portugal that she didn't like to see that when she... Because bullfight was always connected to the aristocracy, you know, and the nobleman people and everything. Because to raise horses and bulls is not something cheap.
Right. So it was from a queen.
A queen that didn't like... how the bullfight ended, and she basically outlawed the killing of the bull.
She was like 150 years ahead of her time with just like a shred of human compassion for these animals. So she didn't like to see it, and she outlawed.
And they had to find a kind of replacement to finish, let's say, the party, the bullfight. And there was already a kind of tradition of these men that they used to, on the village, grab the bulls by the horns and fight over. And I don't know the specifics who decide then how they're going to do it, but the reality was that then it starts the Forcados groups and they will be finishing the bullfight. And so basically what happens is that you still have like the horsemen running around and putting sticks on the bull. And then instead of killing the bull, what they do is this goes this group of men to the arena and they wrestle the bull. So the bull runs to them and they have to grab the bull with their own bare hands, with no protection, nothing. They only have a waist band that they put around their chest to protect the internal organs. And other than that, it's crazy. You have 15-year-old people, men, are kids, basically with 15-year-olds, and just jumping to them and to 600 kilo bulls running to you. And it's quite scary, and but it's quite interesting because it's a tradition, you know, that you don't have anywhere else. But we actually managed to export it to Mexico.
So they now have forcado culture there?
Yeah, there was a group of bullfighters that came to Portugal and they were amazed with it, and they decided to start their own group in Mexico.
I mean, if you want to talk about, listen, we're all trying to prove ourselves as macho motherfuckers. Like going without a blade and or without a spear and taking on a bull who is going to remain at full strength until you tire it out with your body seems like very masculine. And at the end of the day, the bull lives.
Exactly.
It's just, you know, maybe a little punked, a little defeated, a little tired, a little humiliated, but it gets to go and you know, eat and screw and run like bulls do.
Not really. It's the funny thing. Well, uh-oh. Not funny. The bull doesn't have a usually a nice end as well. Because bulls only live after the bullfight here if they prove that they are really amazing bulls.
So this was not a detail that I remembered.
No.
Okay.
If they give a proper fight and they... It's like, oh, this is a remarkable bull. You will have, yeah, the life that you were describing. You know, he's just going to eat and screw and reproduce himself, and he's going to be the king with the RM around him.
He'll be a stud.
Exactly.
Okay.
But if it doesn't prove itself, what it does, because bulls cannot return to the bullfight or the arena. They only do it once because they are quite smart and they learn how things work. So, you know, they start and they become even more dangerous.
God love them. They're smart enough to realize, oh, I remember this bullshit from last time.
Yeah, so
15 men jumping on top of me to wrestle me down. No, thank you.
So basically what they do usually, and now it's a law, is that when the bull retires from the arena, they usually kill it for steaks and everything.
Uh-huh. Okay.
But it goes to a slaughterhouse. Actually, I think it was ruled like last year or 2 years ago, is that the arenas have to have a slaughterhouse.
Really? Right there?
Yeah, because the problem, and this is now with the animal rights and everything, is that before, if you have a bullfight, let's say on a Friday or a Saturday, the bull stays closed there suffering until Monday, that opens the slaughterhouse to kill the bull.
Got it. So the bull's tired and he's... been defeated
and bleeding and everything.
Yeah. Okay.
And so people understood that that was a bit not nice to the animal. So what they tried to do was to, okay, if we put a facility to kill the bull in the place, as soon as he leaves the arena, they can kill it and the animal doesn't suffer anymore.
We will put a link in the show notes. The images that you have from forcado fights and cultures are so stunning because it's this mixture of kind of traditional wear, the bands that they you know put around their torsos to protect their internal organs, the blood, which is as often, at least in my recollection, as often of the forcados themselves as it is of the bulls. I mean, it's like,
yeah,
they're kind of, I mean, it's serious hand-to-hand combat. And it just always struck me as a very uniquely Portuguese thing that you have just a way with your photography of kind of bringing out. So you grew up here, but have somehow decided since 16 years ago that your life, you know, at least thus far, is not going to be lived here. How did you end up going overseas and why and where does it go from here?
Well, I always had this kind of thing that I wanted to be abroad, even... When I didn't travel at all, I always had this thing, I want to see the world. A lot fueled by my grandfather. He was a colonel from the army and he was a amateur photographer. And he traveled all over the world. He was a captain of police in Macau in 1952, which is quite funny because nowadays I live there. And
you're retracing the journey.
Yeah, and he lived in Angola, in the time of the colonial war, and basically because I grew up with him, and I remember he always pushed this thing to me and my brother, but obviously influenced me much more because I kind of took off that path. And I usually say that he gave me the wheels of my life, which is travel and photography, And I remember we were kids and it was like, imagine the news on TV and there was like a bomb blast in Islamabad or something. And he's like, where is Islamabad? And we're like, oh, and then sometimes we were kids, we were still small. And we're like, okay. And then like, oh, it's Pakistan, you know? And then basically we'll open Atlas and it will show us the maps and it'll say, and start teaching us about the partition of India and things like that. So that was a something common that happened at his house and at the dinner or lunch table. And with that, I start, you know, I got this curiosity about the world. And when I was 23, I just finished my journalism degree here in Portugal. And I had set already in my mind that I don't want to be a journalist and don't know about the world. Because I basically never traveled before, except a small trip to Morocco with some friends. But so I just decided to leave and go live life. And not working as a journalist, I went to do wash dishes, I drive a rickshaw in Edinburgh, you know, clean mussels, do phone calls, like, you know, like studies for government. I did, I think, everything, bartending, you know, all these things. And slowly building up my career as a photographer. That's what I want to do, but I didn't want to do here. I always look and I to my life and always wanted to be part of a bigger world than Portugal. And so it was, and you know, and I never took like a plan if I go 1 year or 2 years or 10 years and I want to just live here. I always took my life a bit like I go with the flow,
yeah,
or be like water, you know, and adapt to the circumstances and what it brings, throws to you. Opportunities, just take it and see where it takes you in the end and go to the next one and things. And basically, yeah, I lived in Scotland, in London, in Peru, in Colombia. I spent a lot of time in South America. And now, because of mostly because of love, I moved to China. So from Colombia, I moved to Macau, which is, there's nothing to do with each other.
That is true. Very different, very, very different destinations.
But because of this particular reason, you know, I felt, well, maybe life is giving me, throwing me a sign. And I always had this curiosity about Asia. I traveled in Asia for 1 year as a backpacker while I was discovering the world between these odd jobs that I used to have. And, well, I always had this dream one day I would like to go to Asia and maybe life, you know, put my girlfriend in the way. And I was like, okay, maybe this is the call for Asia now.
There it is, as you know, me personally not believing in God, but definitely believing in a church of Francesinha sandwiches.
Much better church.
Maybe Francesinha put this woman in your path, and that's led you to Macau. I mean, it's kind of, you talked about your grandfather before. I knew that he had been in the army, but it's kind of interesting that a kind of colonial time had led to your own wanderlust or something, because one of the things that immediately, and we're talking very long ago now, like six years ago, I might have first seen your work, but one of the things that really struck me was you were on the team of the people who you shot, in a way. It's like, it's very compassionate, it's like very humanistic work, which is not something that I think, you know, in my mind describes a colonial period. It feels very anti-colonial or uncolonial, the work that you do and the way that you, you know, for you to live and work in South America, like you wanted to really immerse yourself and be there. And you know, the stuff that you did in Venezuela, for example, during, you know, some of their many crises in the recent past is like, I mean, it's like, it's very compassionate. It's dangerous work, but it's really like being, you know, being with the people in and among them, which, you know, is maybe it's table stakes for photojournalism at the level you're doing it, but it feels particularly pronounced with your work. I mean, fuck, you and I traveled through Brazil, and worked together during the World Cup. So I guess that was a former colony, but you're now living in Macau in a former Portuguese colony. What is that like for you as someone who's clearly Portuguese and now living in this place that had once been a territory of Portugal? Like, how's that experience for you?
Truly, it's quite odd because you have this reminiscent of, you know, the old past, and you have a lot of the community that still believes that they live in the old times, and in some way they don't want to accept it.
These are like Portuguese or Chinese, mostly Portuguese.
Okay. But they still stayed behind and they behave a bit like the old times, and they feel that they have the right to live as they live and everything.
And you, I mean, this is something I get more than enough as a white guy in the U.S. But I'm sure you, as a Portuguese person, then become a vessel in which they can spit all of their weird bullshit and like racist ideas or whatever. They're like, oh, he's Portuguese.
Yes, Portuguese. Well, and then I take it wrongly because I don't see the world that way.
Right.
And for me, it's quite odd because in a way, when I went to Macau, I was quite excited to be a bit closer to home because it's been 16 years that I've been completely outside of Portugal. Well, I come here sometimes to see family, but, you know, it's a minimum amount of time I pass here. And I was like, oh, for the first time, I will have this a bit of home next to me. And I'm still traveling and then the other side of the world, but at the same time I start discovering that I don't think maybe this is that so great, you know, because some things are, I could eat a francesinha there, but it's not the same, and I am betraying my own church, let's say.
Right. And it's true that the only the thing that travels better out of a colonial mentality isn't the food, because the products aren't the same, but maybe that just kind of weird bullshit. I can imagine, you know, for myself going to, you know, go to Guam or somewhere. There's places in the Caribbean also where, San Miguel Allende, you know, where you'll have like Americans who are just kind of like, I'm like, I recognize that mentality and I wish it hadn't followed me here, you know? Yeah. But there are those little touches, right? There's like francesinha. There's a guy from Porto who's making francesinha sandwiches.
There's a guy from,
yeah.
He has his own restaurant and he cooks other dishes, like the one we were saying, papas de sarrabulho, that we were talking to you yesterday.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
The blood soup.
Yes. So,
it's nice to have those things even, you know. But some ways it's weird. I think it's a mix of feeling. In a way, it's nice that I have some things from home. But I don't want too much because I also, for that, I will return home. I don't want too much because I still want to feel that I'm somewhere far, 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 you know, from home and having this life experience that I will not have it here.
Yeah.
Because if it's to stay in my own bubble, let's say, my Portuguese bubble, well, I will come back home and live in Portugal. And that's what it took me to go outside. It was not that I was angry with the country or nothing. I just want to have a completely different experience that I will never have here.
Right. And, you know, the fact that you're dating and living with a woman who grew up in Macau, and your work is taking you to Hong Kong for the protests and throughout Southeast Asia, like, it feels like you're getting that healthy dose. You're not sort of in some weird colonial recording loop, you know, trying to find a slice of Portugal wherever you can get it. It is interesting. One of the things that you notice, besides the Roli people and their unbelievably loud wheels on their suitcases, is the age of people here. It feels like an older population. And in part, like, that's because the you of your generation and the ones that have followed continue to leave the country. I think your brother is also overseas. And yep. It feels like a common story, I think, for Portuguese.
It is. Well, I'm from a bit different because when I left the country, we were still not in economical crisis. And I left for different reasons.
Right.
But a few years after, so basically I left in 2003, in 2008 came the economical crisis, and I noticed that, well, my brother is one of the examples, and other people that from my generation, that they had to leave because there was no opportunities. And this is still happening a bit here. It's why the government is giving incentives to, you know, you don't pay taxes if you return back to Portugal and things like that.
Oh, is that true?
For a year or two, I think. They launch a program. So basically they try to attract the people that left, because the reality, and Portugal was a country that all these people migrated from. You know, if you go to Canada or you go to Newark, and, you know, you have these big communities of Portuguese, and even in Rio de Janeiro or in Venezuela, France, you know, Portuguese, we were always kind of a a migrating nation, right. People. And
I mean, you always had the boats.
Exactly. Since the beginning, basically, of our history, we went always out.
Yeah.
But this generation was completely, there was something that distinguished between the rest. It was the first generation was highly educated. And, you know, people, they had degrees and everything, because I don't think in our history there was so many people graduating from university as the last, you know, decade, right. Two decades.
Who could have kind of
steady jobs, because that was the hopes of our parents. It was like, you know, in their time, if you have a degree, you have your life done, you get a job, and the next 40 years you're going to work probably in the same company, and you're going to have kids and have a house and everything. But the reality is that's not what happens anymore,
right? That's and, a very typical broken social contract situation.
Yeah,
but with a lot of force here.
And with this generation, basically, then people realize, I finished the degree and I don't have a job. And I'm still living with my parents, and I don't have any prospects for future. So after 2008, and a lot of people start leaving and looking for better life, which is completely fair. You know, it happens everywhere in the world. The only difference is here is we have a nicer passport than the people, for example, that runs from other places.
Right. So those options to escape, you know,
I'm much more open and easy. It's funny because I heard and I had a lot of arguments, especially when it was the big, well, it's still happening, just news don't talk about it, but the migrations from Africa coming to Europe and everything.
Yeah.
And I heard people here like, oh yeah, we shouldn't open, people come here. And then you're like, but you were abroad, you know? So what's the difference? Why? Because you have a nicer passport, or have some more money, or because these people, they are also educated and everything. They are fleeing wars, and you know, and I had a lot of these arguments. And sometimes I have to leave dinners in the middle because it was getting too heated, the discussion, because I couldn't accept that some people that actually had that privilege.
Right.
To go live abroad and everything, but couldn't accept that people could come here as well in the same way, you know?
Right, especially for a people, you know, of whom you could say, like, one of their richest traditions is getting in a fucking boat.
Exactly.
And improving
and go somewhere
their
else.
Lives, you know?
And
like, if you can't see the commonality between, you know, people who are literally right now getting in a fucking boat to improve their lives, and you can't make common cause, then you're trying very hard not to see the connection.
Exactly. And it's funny because even the reason is basically almost the same. It's economical. Because the Portuguese now, in the new generations, they were living is not because they want to live in Sweden in the snow, or, you know, they are living because they pay better wages there. You know? So actually the reason is almost the same. Well, we're not in war, but, you know, I think most of what attracts people and makes movies because they want to provide a better life to their families.
Yep.
And I don't think it was different here. People were saying, okay, here I will never have children, because I cannot even afford to buy a house or rent a flat by my own, and,
yeah.
You know, and I don't even get a job, so I need to go somewhere else. So I don't see the difference, you know. But I had arguments, as I said, about people that didn't saw that.
I remember I was reporting, I think during the U.S. elections, November of 2016, in northern Germany, I was reporting on Nazis. Just went and do a story on neo-Nazis because there was a lot of them in a place I used to live and it sucked. And I had to get in these conversations with people. And, you know, you would have Germans who were trying to tell me, you know, what is especially, like, you know, corrosive and bad about the people who were coming into their country and, you know, why it's just unacceptable by their standards. But, you know, I'd have to explain to them, like, my great-grandfather was from northern Germany and he stuck his ass in, like, the hold of a container ship from Bremerhaven to escape economic hardship and flee completely 1,000% illegally. And he landed in Galveston, Texas, had no idea where the ship was actually going to show up. And it was like, again, that same thing. It was like, if you don't see that, and that's a fucking German, like a dude you would love because he's so German, mm-hmm. sausage eating, all of the stuff, you know, and that you somehow have erased that part, like a guy mm-hmm. like that from your history, and the idea that Germans have also fled on boats, not for any better reason than the really great reason of trying to make a better life for yourself and your family. But it can be so hard because people are just like, so ahistorical, you know, in those crazy ways, which is a specialty of Americans, but not limited to us, I guess.
No, it's not, unfortunately.
So what's next for you? You are, you're here, you've been here for a month or so, right? Just hanging out, eating as many of these. I feel like we might not have even described what a francesinha sandwich is.
Not yet.
Okay.
No.
That would be, it'd be almost as bad as not eating one.
Yeah.
Francesinha is.
Well, people that are not from here, they usually call it a sandwich, which I think it's completely wrong. Just because it has bread on it doesn't make it a sandwich.
I think I've done that several times in this podcast. And I'm now remembering last night you were like, and people call it a sandwich and that's bullshit. And then I totally forgot that. So don't do what I did, people. Get this in your dome. Francesinha
is not a sandwich.
Why not? Because it's got bread.
It got bread, but you know, if you eat a soup with croutons, it has bread as well and it's not a sandwich. So
it's a bowl sandwich.
Well, and this is a plate sandwich. That's what you call it. I don't know.
Fair enough. Okay, good point. So it's a, think of the slice of bread as a crouton.
Yeah.
Okay.
So basically, francesinha, it's on a plate, you have two slices of bread, usually French bread. It's a bit toasted. And then inside, you have different kinds of meat. Usually, you have a really nice steak, chorizo, ham, linguiça, which I cannot translate in.
Linguiça is totally fine. So it's totally fine. But that's two different kinds of sausage. You got a linguiça and a chorizo.
Chorizo. It depends then of the house. They might change. But usually you have the steak, the ham, and the linguiça.
Okay.
Then sometimes you have chorizo and a few different meats.
Yeah.
Sometimes you have two steaks. It depends where you go as well. And then you have the top of the bread, of the French bread, and then it's covered with cheese. And after the cheese, if you want, and you had yesterday, we put a fried egg.
Yes. Oh,
actually, under the cheese, you put the fried egg and then you put the cheese on top.
I did notice that, yes.
And you melt slightly the cheese with the sauce. And the sauce is the special thing of the francesinha. Because that's what makes it like it's the Bible of each church, let's say. Because the sauce, each place has its own sauce. They have its own secret. And, you know, maybe if you like a bit more spicy, a bit more dry, or, you know, it depends where you go because you have all these ingredients. And the sauce usually is always a tomato sauce.
Yeah.
And then you can use it beer. As Diogo was saying yesterday, I didn't know that actually, that sometimes they only use the foam of the beer, whiskey. They can make a shrimp stock. And then they mix that and they made a really rich sauce. And then they pour over to the francesinha. And that helps to melt the cheese. And then you can eat it.
So thank you for that explanation. I mean, the effect that you get on a single plate is, and this is where, you know, maybe you dispute the use of the word sandwich, because the effect is not sandwich-like. It's much more like, holy fuck, how am I going to finish this thing? It's like a mix of like that fondue dread of just like, holy crap, this is so much cheese. But then also like all of the meats and
French fries.
And then
I forgot the French fries that you have to soak in the sauce.
Listen, Portuguese are wonderful people. I caught a lot of shit for not putting French fries on the plate yesterday. There's just some bullying going on. I ended up putting a lot of French fries and of course it was great. I mean, it's like the sauce is, you know, at least at this place, its particular Bible is to have a pretty runny sauce and you're just kind of like, you have this giant cheese and meat and bread concoction swimming in this secret, you know, ocean of
special sauce,
the house sauce. It's interesting because I think in a place that can make a little or make a lot out of a little, this is a feeling of like such complete abundance and overindulgence on a single plate with something that's not, it doesn't cost a lot in the restaurant. It probably doesn't cost a ton to make, but it's just like, it's overwhelming. It's meant to just make the world seem like a beautiful place where you're always going to have enough to eat and it's always going to be delicious and melty. And like, I found it a totally beguiling metaphor for making the most out of a circumstance, which is having an egg and bread and some cheese and meats, you know. It's that is a francesinha. And I am so glad that you were so nervous about me not getting one in my time here in Porto.
I will not live with myself.
I did send a picture to Matt, and I was, you know, because he, Matt Goulding is coming in today. He texted me on WhatsApp, as he often does. I think one of the first questions was like, what are we doing for dinner? You know, he's like flying internationally. He doesn't want to know how to get home from the airport or where, you know, he's like, first question, what are we doing for dinner? So I sent him a picture of the Francesinha, and I was like, you know, God be with you. We might do this again.
Why so not?
Why? Well, I can think of some like good, maybe health reasons why not. I can't.
Well, you didn't have the breakfast probably or lunch today.
Because that is
still
true.
Digesting the last one. So,
I am. If you got to do one meal a day and that's your jam, then.
You can live on Francesinha's then.
Francesinha's. Thank you, Eduardo, for looking after my caloric bliss and for the incredible work that you do, which I hope people will take a look at. You are such a talented photojournalist, but even more than that, you know, which I know from having worked with you and traveled with you, you're what journalists should be. You're a great person. I appreciate it.
I'm getting red now.
I think that's
the wine.
That's the Vinho Verde.
The Trip from Roads and Kingdoms is hosted by me, Nathan Thornburg. Alexa Van Sickle is our editor. Music by Dan the Automator. Episode illustration by Daisy D. Show artwork by Adele Rodriguez. Executive producers are me and Matt Goulding, also of Roads and Kingdoms. Next week, it's Ansel Mullins, co-founder of Culinary Backstreets, who has made Portugal his home because he's no dummy and because this is where you get the good fish and the good beer at the best price, and life is good, even in lockdown, in this country. We drink some kind of sweet, spiced Cape Verdean liquor and wax nostalgic about the old days in Istanbul and what is next for him and Culinary Backstreets. We will meet you there.